I was told to advertise other topics that I'd be interested to discuss before the end of my time here, and so I wanted to show you some vignettes of topics that I hope to have time to discuss, informally or whenever anybody would like to, if you're interested, and then we'll get to the main thing. These are little vignettes from a presentation for Zach Fisk's 60th birthday, which was a little bit, not quite a year ago. Anyway, this first one has to do with the issue of whether the Fermi surface in materials, the heavy fermion materials above their Kondo temperature would or would not contain the F electrons. And we think we have evidence in a very particular system where a lot of the Hassmann-Alfvén has been done and where there's a built-up understanding of the Fermi surface and so on, that perhaps the F electrons are excluded from the Fermi surface above the Kondo temperature, whereas the Hassmann-Alfvén measuring below the Kondo temperature sees them included. And so we have Fermi surface maps from certain key materials, and I just like, you know, at some point, that's a topic I would like to discuss, because I think that I think these dynamic mean field calculations could be really, really helpful to us in trying to understand data like this. And then we've worked a lot on the divalent hexaborides and the issue of whether or not there's a band gap. And through that problem, I've discovered that this whole topic of whether you can calculate band gaps successfully seems not to be as closed as I thought it was back in the mid-80s. When the issue came up for things like silicon and germanium, and Steve Louie and his collaborators did their work. So this is a system where it matters a lot for the physics of the material whether or not there's a band gap, and we've done photo emission and also some X-ray absorption and emission to try to get at that issue, and we think there's a band gap, but various theorists think there isn't, and various theorists think there are. And here's a collection of people that we've been discussing this issue with. And I had the impression, did somebody say Wei Ku was coming here?
Yes, he'll be here tomorrow.
So maybe that's a topic I might get a chance to chat with some of you about privately or whatever. This is a quasi one-dimensional system where we think we can make a case to you that we see line shapes that can be argued to be consistent with a Luttinger liquid kind of picture, and that other properties of the material don't contradict that. And then there are extended ideas and data that have to do with low-dimensional bronzes. And so that's a topic I would love to discuss with anybody interested in these low-dimensional kinds of systems. So then the topic that I really want to spend some time on is B203. And this is one where, since the Fisk Fest, things have changed a lot. And so that was one reason why I wanted to discuss it with you as a kind of an example of how things can happen to you when you do experimental physics that were pretty unexpected. Even when you thought you knew what you were doing, you get surprised. And so that's the thing I really wanted to come to. And then I know there's quite a lot of interest here in this issue of the V203 system. So let's see what I want to do. Let's say slideshow. We'll make it big. So our effort on this problem goes back to the late 80s and the early 90s, and my interest goes back a lot further than that. And there are a lot of different people who have worked on this at one time or another and are active on it now. Much of the data that I'll show you today comes from a collaboration with Professor Suga, who has a fancy new beamline at the Spring 8 synchrotron in Japan, and I've been very fortunate that he was willing to let us come and do work on his beamline. This is the student at Michigan who's now involved in the work, and I probably should have on here Jonathan Denlinger, who did a key thing at the Advanced Light Source, and I should have gotten Jonathan's name on here, but you'll see his name on some of the other slides. I think that probably we don't need a heck of a lot of background for this audience on this topic, but here is the famous phase diagram that was generated at Bell Labs in the late 60s and early 70s, in which one saw three different phases. And the, of course, this transition in pure V2O3, or zero applied pressure from a metal to an antiferromagnetic insulator, had been known for a long time. This group, actually working with some earlier data that was generated at Lincoln Lab, the Lincoln Lab people like to say that, and since I was at Lincoln Lab once, I should mention that, found out that as you apply pressure, or as you dope the material with various dopants, titanium or chromium, for example, you develop this full phase trend diagram. And this transition is quite important then in the concept of the thing, because here you can go from a metal to an insulator without magnetism being involved. And nominally, since this is a critical point, there's no difference in the symmetry of the crystal across this phase boundary. So this was an important phase transition, and it was interpreted by the Bell group as the Mott transition, and interpreted in terms of the Brinkman and Rice picture for the one-band Hubbard model. Since then, there have been interesting new developments exploring what happens as you tune the vanadium stoichiometry, and there's another phase that appears, and I'm not going to talk about that, but I mentioned it to you.
Jim,
yeah.
Could you remind us if there are, I've forgotten, if there are or are not discontinuous changes of lattice parameter across that phase boundary?
Yeah, there are jumps in lattice parameters across the phase boundary. It's a first order phase transition. Here there's a change of crystal symmetry, and here just changes of A and C constants for this hexagonal unit cell.
Is there a discontinuity or
it's actually a jump.
Jump.
Yeah.
It's not that the crystal breaks up, it seems to be a quite drastic transition.
Different people seem to have different experience with that. I think the transport people often said that the material shattered when they tuned through the phase transition. We have found when you take thin samples and glue them down, which we do for the way we mount them and cleave them, that we don't have trouble with things breaking. However, my student developed a technique for cleaving, which actually involves going very near the phase boundary and then setting up a little temperature gradient. And it turns out that seems to stress the material and it makes it easier to cleave. So this issue is lurking around. Yeah. Well, some standard history, and I imagine a lot of you know this. There was a whole series of papers by McGuan and Rice and their collaborators at Bell in this period, and essentially putting forth arguments that said that you could interpret this in terms of the one-band Hubbard model. And this involved, as I'll show you a little picture a little bit later, finding ways to do away with a couple of the, with at least some of the orbital degrees of freedom in the system. And Castellani took up this issue of what do I do with the extra electronic degrees of freedom, and proposed orbital ordering as a way to get rid of this unwanted extra internal degrees of freedom. And this, I think, paper was maybe largely ignored for quite a number of years, perhaps because it came a little bit after the main surge of interest in the problem. And then in the early 90s, Gaby Cotillard and Antoine Georges and Dieter Fohlhart developed these ideas of the dynamic mean field theory and applied them to the one-band Hubbard model. And there had been some analysis of optical spectroscopy and some work on UV photoemission to try to get at this dynamic mean field theory picture. So for me, it was extraordinarily interesting, this whole picture. In the time when I first learned about the Mott transition, there was this idea that the correlation gap would simply collapse or fill in as the bandwidth got big enough. And the new picture that evolved out of this K-independent self-energy picture was that one could bootstrap a condo resonance-like thing into the gap and gradually build up weight, which was quite a different picture for how the transition would come about. And since I had been working on the condo, trying to observe the condo resonance in cerium materials, of course, this is an extremely attractive idea to me, but I didn't have a good sense of whether I believed it, and I'm only now beginning to really believe it, and I'll show you why that's happening for me. There's temperature dependences here in the central peak as a part of the whole picture. And there was some photo emission which was done in 1995 for V2O3, actually photo emission that was one of a number of papers dating back maybe 20 years on this problem. But these are fairly typical spectra, I would say, of what people had been able to generate working in the lab and at synchrotrons using photon energies in the general range of less than 100 EVs. And one sees a blob of stuff, which is the 3D band, the vanadium 3D band. Here's a Fermi edge, so it's a metal at high temperatures, and you lower the temperature and you see something that's kind of insulator-like. I won't go through all of these bits and pieces of their paper, but I think the part that Gabi was interested in and pointed out to me at one point was that they had measured the spectrum at 300K and 200K and then taken the difference and seen a kind of a decrease here and an increase there. And the argument was that this was to be interpreted in terms of this temperature dependence of a central peak, which is obviously not directly visible in the spectra. And that was one reason why I was never very convinced about the idea of the dynamic mean field theory, because there never was a peak. And I've been seeing peaks in cerium materials that were really peaks, and there just wasn't anything there. So that bothered me. And of course, we know that the Kondo resonance itself can have very small weight if the Kondo temperature is really small. But on the other hand, V2O3 ought to be in some regime of parameters where things would be big. So that's the nut of it. In the background of all this are these issues of realism that I mentioned to you early. That is, if you look at how many atoms there are per unit cell, vanadiums, and you count up all the orbitals, you got a lot of states per cell and a lot of electrons per cell. And if you really figure out what all the orbitals are, it's a lot more complicated than a one-band Hubbard model. And there were lots of clever arguments, I think, made in the early days. John Goodenough, Herb Zeiger, I already mentioned the Castellani paper, trying to deal with and make phenomenologies out of all of this. And quite, I think, some quite pretty papers in the early days looking at this problem. Well, there are probably newer work that involved the idea that you should take this multiband model seriously. Some theoretical work that involves my friend George Zavatsky, finding out that probably solutions of LDA plus U with spin 1 were lower energy than other possibilities. Some X-ray scattering and some polarization-dependent X-ray absorption that was done by a former student of mine with data analysis done in Jordan Spotsky's group. All, and probably the fact that the spin comes out to be 1 apparently on the vanadium site is the simplest way to say that it's not just a one-band Hubbard model. Then there have been a couple of papers that have explored analytic versions of correlated electron models of C-axis pair states in this system. And then, perhaps central to the topic of this workshop, work done by Carsten Held in Dieter Fullhardt's group using LDA plus DMFT with this multiband realism, and then trying to really calculate the single particle spectral function. And the idea is that once you do that, a person like me can try to measure it and compare it to photo emission and see what you get. So this is the only one where I have these fancy arrows that come flying in. But just to remind you a little bit about the idea of, it's actually designed to talk about angle-resolved photoemission, but we won't do that. But I need to at least have the ideas of angle-resolved photoemission lurking in the background. So it's photons in and electrons out, and we measure the kinetic energy, and from that we try to deduce the binding energy. We take electrons out at certain angles, theta and phi, relative to the sample normal, which I guess is, so here we're collecting electrons. and we measure an energy distribution function, and we interpret that as the spectral function rho times a Fermi function and times a cross-section. That's the idea. This cross-section is important, partly because we can't get rid of it, but also we can sometimes use it to advantage. There are certain resonances that appear in this cross-section that are specific to atom and angular momentum for photon energies at certain core levels, and that can be used as a trick to try to get at particular states that we care about and that we're interested in. It's also, have to remember, that as you vary these angles, you move on a spherical surface in K-space, and the radius of that surface is fixed by the photon energy. So this is real space, but picture now out here some K-space, and as you change these angles, you're moving on a spherical surface in K-space, and the radius of that circle is determined by the component of K along the normal, and that's varying with the photon energy. So that's a little picture you could have in your mind. And so K perpendicular changes with photon energy, and even as you go through these resonances, you're also moving in K space, which is something we didn't really realize, I think, in the early days. Another thing that happens is that as you go to higher photon energy, you get larger kinetic energies and a larger elastic escape depth. And in consequence, higher photon energy means more bulk sensitive. So a lot of stuff is going on as you change the photon energy, and you have to kind of keep that in your head, and you'll see that I struggle with that a little bit in looking at the data that I'm going to show you. And then there are these three modes of taking data, so-called momentum distribution functions and Fermi surface maps, and I won't show you any of that. The basic thing is the so-called energy distribution curve. You fix K, pick an angle, and scan the frequency and generate a spectrum for a certain K. Well, there was actually early evidence for bulk surface differences in V2O3 found by my student, Jae-hoon Park. These are spectra taken at 110 EVs and 500 EVs at the Dragon Beamline, which is now defunct, at the National Light Source. This is V2O3. This is the oxygen 2P band. And he found that there was a change in the peak height here near the Fermi energy, and even something kind of peaky. And his idea was at the time that this had to do with maybe this was more bulk sensitive and that was somehow more characteristic of the bulk. But at that time, the Dragon Beamline, which was the state of the art, still didn't have particularly good resolution at these very high photon energies. 400 millivolts won't sound like much to you guys now that you're used to hearing people give talks where the resolution's much better than that. So we really couldn't follow that up. This is just a little picture to give you a feeling for, I don't have anything detailed to say about this, but this is the unit cell of this stuff, and laid out as though it was hexagonal, although in fact it's trigonal. And the cleavage plane is the 101 bar 2. That's the one that naturally easily cleaves. Well, it's not so easy, as you'll see. And if you actually look at the surface from different points of view, this is how it looks. And these green and blue atoms are vanadium sitting in various sites, and you see they're right up here on the surface. And so you could imagine that the surface layer of this stuff, you know, might well, in fact, be not the same as something that you would measure if you could look at the atoms only further down in the material. I think, in fact, it turns out that our spectrum may be very much dominated by things like steps, in which it's not just the surface layer, but it's also corner atoms that result from steps, and I'll show you a hint of that in some pictures later. So the idea was that we would go to Spring 8, work with Professor Suga on his wonderful new beamline, go to high photon energies, try to measure V2O3 with good resolution, where good would be, say, 100 millivolts or less. Still not what you can do at low photon energies like cuprate work. You see people quoting numbers like 20 millivolts or 5 millivolts or 10, but still very, very good for this particular photon energy range. And we've looked at a variety of different samples, and I'll show you some of those if there's time.
By having such a high frequency photon, don't you lose a little bit of your momentum resolution?
Yeah, you sure do. I mean, that's one of the prices that you pay, that as just the projection of the uncertainty due to angle back onto the KZ axis is produces a bigger uncertainty in K for a given uncertainty and angle.
So what would be your momentum resolution? You state that energy.
You can probably still resolve here with a Sienta analyzer that's now been on the beam line. You can maybe still resolve 10 or 15% of a Brillouin zone. So it's not ludicrous to think about doing it. And we are thinking about doing it, although I have to say so far that the data are not encouraging that it's going to be easy to see angle resolved effects in this material. But on the other hand, we have made some advances that make us think we're beginning to understand better how to do it. So if this was the FISFest talk, I would have spent quite a lot of time telling you the following quickie stuff. And I would have said there is one of these resonant enhancement phenomena at the vanadium 2p edge that comes in the vicinity of 500 to 517 EVs. You tune at 517 EVs, and this spectrum of oxygen plus vanadium changes to this, and you see that the vanadium stuff gets absolutely huge. And so the concept was that we would simply go to this resonance. We would use that to get good signal-to-noise ratio with good statistics, and that's where we would take the data. At that time, the way the beamline operated, we could take data off resonance, say at 500 EV, with not such good statistics. But this shows you the insulator phase and the metal phase, and the little dots here are the poor statistics of the off-resonance spectrum, and the solid lines are the better statistics of the on-resonance spectrum. And we convinced ourselves that in fact, these were essentially the same. And so we claimed that we were just using the resonance to get good signal-to-noise, and that the on-resonance spectrum really gave us the right spectral function. That's not turned out to be true.
Did you say the blue and red curves are essentially the same?
Now, the argument was that within the bad statistics, that these little dot things here were essentially the same as the solid curves. So compare blue and blue and red and red. And within that framework, we weren't lying, and I'll show you that. But it turned out not to be correct, and other aspects turned out not to be right in this early work either. So we produced some figures, which are even in a CONMAT preprint, and they compared spectra taken at various places in this phase diagram with material that was doped up with different amounts of chromium to reach different places here, insulator to insulator transition across. I guess it's this phase boundary. This is increasing chromium doping that way. Insulator metal transition. And we compared it to the dynamic mean field calculations that were done by Karsten Held and Dieter Fohlhardt's group. And we made a little story out of this. And in fact, we ended up arguing that in the metallic phase that there was rather good agreement between theory and experiment. And we pointed out little things like, well, the theory was peaking a bit below the chemical potential, and so was the data. And on the other hand, we argued that there wasn't very a good agreement in the insulator phase and things like that. And then we noticed that as a function of photon energy, as you increase the photon energy and you look at various people's data, the thing at the chemical potential gets bigger. But you have to say that it's still not very impressive as a peak. So that was the situation. Here was a comparison of LDA plus dynamic mean field theory, and I now emphasize, done at 1100 kelvins, that's the restriction of the quantum Monte Carlo part of the calculation, and we've taken the data that we had at that time and compared it to the theory. 5 EVs for the U value was what they reckoned would allow you to get the phase transition to happen by just changing the lattice parameters from what they were for V203 to what they are in chrome doped V203. That was the idea of the calculation, that it would all be internally consistent. And Dieter very kindly calculated for various U values and pointed out to us that, well, they could fit the data pretty well with 4.95 EV, which wasn't far from 5. You see that actually this moves very rapidly as a function of U. And so we were compelled to say to Dieter, okay, you know, the data's pretty good with your theory. And it sat like that. until we did some kind of preliminary work with some stolen beam time at the advanced light source. Had some beam time, for one reason or another, the samples we intended to work on didn't work out. And so we decided we'd have a look at B203. This is a spectral microscopy beamline. It's made specifically with a small photon spot and a fairly high energy capability, but without the resolution of the Sprague-8 beamline. And so we measured through this resonance thing from around 500 eV out to 550 or 60 eV quite carefully in half eV steps here. And over this wide photon energy range, without such good resolution, if you plot up the spectra, you see some streaks of stuff here that are moving in the spectrum. It's a binding energy scale spectrum. And when you see stuff that's moving like that, that's usually a sign to you that you're seeing OJ emission, because OJ emission has a constant kinetic energy. It's just an incoherent process. You make a core hole, and electrons dump back down into the core hole and then jump out of the solid, and the kinetic energy is determined only by the core hole. So in fact, it doesn't vary with the photon energy. And so when you plot it on a binding energy scale, you see things that just shift linearly with the photon energy. And so if you extrapolate this stuff back, you discover, you infer, that there's probably some incoherent OGA emission accompanying this resonant enhancement. And that's a warning sign. That's going to be bad, because such contributions can give you line shape artifacts. And it turns out that really happens in this system. The really, really big shock was that tuning around on the sample surface with the small spot, which is about 100 microns, generated some spectra that looked like this. I mean, in some sense, this is the high point of the talk, and it's downhill from here. But I showed you what I thought was reality for what the metal phase looked like. And here Gabi is your central peak. I mean, that's I think for real. We have not reproduced anything quite this tall yet. But in fact, we know this is for real. It was done at a particular photon energy, and it generated a lot of questions. I mean, for me, this is a big problem, because I think I already have a nice story to tell. I put a paper out on the ConMat server thinking we had done the best thing you could do. We'd go and do a sort of a knockoff experiment at the ALS on a different beamline, and suddenly I got a lot of new results. So you can't just get two different answers when you go to a different beamline. So, you know, what's happening? Is it some special photon energy and some magic thing happens? Are we seeing hints of K resolution in the spectra that makes a peak come up? Is it the spot size? We had a millimeter spot at spring 8, 100 micron spot here on the spectral microscopy beamline, and I was pretty upset. Interested, but upset too. So we went back to Spring 8. We had beam time in April of this year. We had intended to try to do high photon energy angle resolved photoemission on these samples, and instead we spent all the time doing photoemission, essentially going back over the grounds. And we got lucky, because in the time since I had been there last, the beamline had been modified to decrease the spot size from a millimeter to 100 microns. Same as the ALS, but still with the good resolution. And it turned out that also increased the intensity of the photons on the region we were measuring. And that, in turn, enabled us to measure off-resonance spectra with good signal-to-noise. So we found out, yes, there is OJ contributions in the resonant photoemission line shape. It's not huge. This is the anti-ferromagnetic insulator phase of B203. And these differences between the on-resonance spectrum and the off-resonance spectrum aren't huge. You can see that they're within the kind of bad statistics of the off-resonance spectrum we had before. This is a bit of OJ. That's one of those streaky lines coming in. And this is a little bit of OJ. It's more important down here in the metal phase. Again, here's this tail coming in in this region. But look here. The thing that I was so proud of, the peaking below the chemical potential that I thought was in beautiful agreement with the dynamic mean field calculations at 1100 kelvins, in fact, is an artifact. Within the resolution, the thing really is just coming up to the chemical potential and then cutting off. It's embarrassing, but that's just how it is. This is this data I showed you before, where now it's green and now it's red and green and red and green. But you can see that if you make the off-resonance spectrum with this kind of statistics and you plot them the way we did, you'll claim that it's not that they're essentially in agreement, but it wasn't so. Well, okay, so now we know that resonant photoemission is maybe a dangerous thing to do, and we have this concern that maybe we're seeing some special K-dependent effects in this peaky object, so we have to think a little bit about that. And so here's a picture of the Brillouin zone now for the 1.01 bar 2 cleavage plane. So this is the stacking of Brillouin zones perpendicular to the sample surface. And these are these arcs that you move on. So if I fix the photon energy and I vary the angles, I move on a spherical surface, and this is one cross-section through that surface. And these are plotted now where you are in K-space for a variety of different photon energies. We have worked in essentially this range from 300 to 700, and we've taken a whole series of spectra through here. And the reason for that is that we're comparing to an angle integrated spectrum that's been calculated so far, and we certainly will have somebody ask us if it's a valid thing to compare our data to an angle integrated spectrum. So we've worked in an angle integrated mode that sweeps out this much in angle, so that's covering easily a Brillouin zone, and we've taken a lot of detailed spectra through here. And we'll k-average them and get a spectrum that is k-averaged through this region of the Brillouin zone. And I'll show you how the trends then work out. We are avoiding the resonance region because we're afraid of that region now that we know that Auger emission comes up in that range. And so we'll get clear of that. And this is kind of about how high up you can work with reasonable signal to noise and still take some spectra, but it's hard to take this many spectra up here with good signal-to-noise ratio before your beam time runs out. So that's why we've concentrated here to do some detailed stuff. So step one is that the peaky thing is really there. It does matter where you are on the sample surface. You have to tune around in order to see the peaky thing. This is 500 dB, 700 dB. This is 310, where there's this some cross-section enhancement going on here, and I don't know the origin of that. I'll show you plots to show you that the photon energy is not special for seeing the peaky object. What turns out to be the case is that the higher the photon energy, the peakier thing you see, and I think that probably has then to do with the surface sensitivity. This is a sequence of spectra that were taken over this range from 380 to 500, and you can see that there is some variation, but maybe not a huge variation. And in fact, the change, as I'll show you in a minute, from say 500 to 700 is a much bigger effect than whatever variations are going on through this region.
Now, is that a peak or is that a rise cut off by the Fermi edge?
Couldn't tell you. Just can't tell you. In cerium, I know the answer. I know that it's a rise cut off by the Fermi edge, and there's really a resonance sitting above the chemical potential. Here, I couldn't tell you that. But I can say within the resolution, it's not passing through a peak and then going back down again. But that's 90 millivolts, so don't know the answer to that. This is the K-average spectrum. You'll notice that the statistics suddenly get real good because we're averaging a lot of data together. And we have averaged them, not just adding them up for photon energy, but really putting in the K-dependent averaging effects, although it's not a very big effect. This is the spectrum at 700 EVs. This is the average one. You can see that it's a little less, it's less peaky in this averaged spectrum. And so we still could wonder to ourselves if that's because there's some special, we've picked out a KZ where the thing is really peaky in K-space. I think that's not the case. And here is now a figure with a lot of stuff to be learned from, I think. First of all, there are a series of experimental results plotted here from 700 dB 500 eV. C is this average spectrum. D is at 310. That's the quite peaky one. But on this particular surface, we can measure. And this is a spectrum which was done at 60 volts by Schramm et al. In a thesis done in Augsburg. And this is the spectrum to which the 1100 Kelvin theory data was compared in the PRL that was published by Dieter Fullhart and his group. So this was the not too bad agreement between 1100 K theory and the not very peaky peak in as of maybe a couple years ago or 3 years or something like that. And this is the kind of thing that I think is for real in the system. You notice it just gets bigger, and so I'm pretty sure that this average spectrum is a truly average spectrum, but done with a surface sensitivity that's still a little bit too great. And it's better, we would think that it's better to just take the highest photon energy spectrum as being more representative of the spectral function.
What temperature do you have?
It doesn't say here. This is probably, it's about 15 degrees above the phase transition, so it's maybe 175 Kelvin, something like that.
Do you vary that around or not?
We have mostly just changed from phase to phase. We have not really tried to explore the temperature dependence in one particular phase. Also, I'll show you a little bit about that in a moment.
Okay. I just want to emphasize, I mean, the theory, well, I mean, the head curve here was calculated at 1100 Kelvin.
Yes.
Which is sure enough the head of a lot bigger than the coherence temperature. Well, I mean,
yes.
I would expect a drastic reduction of the quasi-particle peak at that temperature.
Yes.
So it doesn't make any sense to...
Yes. Actually, it's very interesting that it's really interesting in the days when we were comparing our not very peaky peak to the theory. Dieter argued to me that maybe in the metal it didn't matter so much.
But
of course, in hindsight, we know it
probably
matters. Probably shouldn't have argued that to me. I'll even show you, this is the one with the one-time only ALS spectrum that started all this, that we have not ever produced something so peaky as that. But it was done at 310, and it sort of tells me that if you can get a really nice surface without steps and things and really just sit on it where your spot only looks at that, it may be that you can probe the bulk even at a lower photon energy. So this kind of a peak would require, if you use the 1100 Kelvin theory, a U value so big that it destroys the ability of the theory to get a phase transition. So, sorry, a U so small that it destroys the ability of the theory to make a phase transition. So we can also have a look to the issue of surface sensitivity in a different way. Another thing that happens as a function of angle is that if you tilt the analyzer direction away from the normal, you begin to effectively increase the surface sensitivity of the experiment. So you picture that coming out of the sample, you have a certain elastic escape depth. And then as you tilt the angle, that escape depth comes along this angle. And so the projection back onto the normal is effectively smaller. And so as you increase the angles, you're also becoming more surface sensitive. And so this is a standard trick in the spectroscopy business to try to look for surface effects. Here what we have done is to try to deliberately avoid true angle-resolved photoemission effects. And so we have averaged a big blob of K-space by taking a big angle, angle average here. And then we've stepped out in big steps. And so the big steps around the normal are plus minus 15 and 30 and 60. And what you find in the data is that this is the sequence. So the peakiest one is at normal emission. The next two, which you might have expected to be perfectly symmetrical, but they aren't, fall. And then as you go to plus 30 and plus 60, falls again and falls again. And now you're beginning to get something that looks a little bit like that 60 eV spectrum that was done compared to in the early paper, and I'm pretty sure that this is mostly, you know, not k-dependent effects, but we're just more and more surface sensitive, and the peak is coming down because it's a more strongly correlated surface. So, okay, so here's the new LDA plus DMFT theory, and you guys already know, I think, because Dieter Folhart was here, what the theory looks like. But they then managed to now do the quantum Monte-Carlo calculations, bringing the temperature down from 1100 to 700 to 300. They also done one for a U value of 4.9 K at 300. And indeed, exactly as you said, this red curve evolves into the black curve. And so there comes now to be something really peaky. I have to say that what I had rather thought might be the case, based on my naive acceptance of the 1100 Kelvin spectrum as being what theory had to say about this, was that when you put in all the realism with multibands and this and that, that perhaps this central peak was kind of washed out, and that the sharp feature was somehow a product of this very simplified one-band model, and that's what I had persuaded myself of maybe a year and a half ago.
But Jim, I mean, as you know, there was a big controversy as to whether there was a mod transition or not, and there are analytic arguments which show that basically that peak is a very robust feature, and it does not depend on whether you go multi-orbital or single orbital. All that changes is just the quantitative details of the shape.
Well convinced that that it's a peaky peak now. I mean, we see a peaky peak experimentally, and the theory is showing us a peaky peak pretty much in the way that the one-band model did. So, you know, it's just wrong about that. But the fact is that until the data that I've shown you today, which is no less than a year old, there was no evidence of any peaky peak in V203. That's just an experimental fact. Okay, so that's the kind of thing that now happens as you lower the temperature. And, you know, I think I probably said to Dieter, you know, in hindsight, both you and I should have known that it may make a lot of difference to lower the temperature in theory. And he said, yeah, we should have. But that's the psychology of the business. This, we always like to see things agree, I guess. So here's some, I would say, initial efforts to make some comparisons. And this is kind of in progress. I mean, we're discussing with Dieter about this now, so this is probably a little bit tentative. It's kind of the result of emails and some initial figures. So I've plotted here the dynamic mean field theory with a Gaussian broadening of 90 millivolts. That's the black one. That's done for 5 EVU value, and it's 300 kelvins. I think I have a couple of different experiment curves here. This red one, which I think is a more representative curve, is for 700 EVs. And this averaged one, which is a little less peaky, is the blue one. And there's some, I would say, qualitative agreement on the presence of a true peak at the chemical potential in this system. This green one, remarkable actually, that Dieter volunteered to actually did this without my asking him, to add some Lorentzian broadening in. It's just a lifetime broadening to see how the spectrum might change. As he said, you know, this is phenomenology, and I don't usually do that. With this kind of extra broadening, you can bring the peak down. But here's what I think where the rubber is going to meet the road. Experimentally, the peak width is really larger than the theory by something like a factor of 2. So that's a big number, and I don't think that's going to go away. Mm-hmm. So that's just true now. I think that's how it is. It's also true that the experimental peak weight is larger than the theory weight. I think we can see that. It's not just a matter of broadening. Maybe there's too many curves here for your eye to work, but if you look at the amount of weight, say compare the red curve with the black curve, and you look at the amount of weight here and the amount of weight there that's different between the curves, it's pretty obvious that there's a genuine difference in the amount of weight. And you will need a smaller U in the theory to get the integrated weight right as it stands. And it could well be that that's still a problem for the internal consistency of the picture, that if you want to get this aspect of the weight distribution between the incoherent peak and the coherent peak to be like what you measure and still get the phase transition, I think it's going to be a problem. And I think that's my tentative statement now. But Dieter and I have discussed this, and we think we're in agreement that that's likely to be so. So we have advanced the thing quantitatively, I think, by having the low temperature theory calculations and spectra that show you something like how big this peak might really be, and we can begin to see these kinds of effects going on, which might be a motivation for thinking about cluster calculations or, you know, some better thing in the theory.
So you're saying a smaller U would not be enough?
If you make the U small enough, I think it will turn out that you're in a regime where you trap it in the metal phase state. Yeah.
Probably what's going on is that the U is frequency dependent, and there's some effective reduction of the U at low frequencies, and therefore the U that controls the metal insulator transition is different than the U that controls the quasi-particle resonance. And now the dynamic of infield theory has already incorporated, at least at the level of models, this U of omega. So that, in principle, can be captured.
You can also imagine it going from one band to multi-band, the U would be different, and then...
No, but this is a multi-band.
This is the multi-band calculation.
I should clarify. I mean, this is a multi-band.
Multi-band. Okay.
Yeah. Yes, this is multi-band, 300 kelvins. Yeah. This is, in fact, it's exactly the model that they published in the PRL, but they just brought the temperature down. I don't know if they had to do anything different with the computers to get the quantum mechanical to run, or if you just let it run a long time. I mean, I just don't know.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
A mild question. Aren't you worried? I mean, you worry about all these details in comparison and changes of U, but the theory is still using essentially a local self-energy, and we know that these materials have strongly non-local effects. And I mean, in principle, should use an excitational description. So one might at least be forced to look at a GW type of extension of these effects and include non-local effects when you go to a more detailed comparison.
I will.
I don't see that it makes sense to play with these detailed questions of U. I mean, the Coulomb interaction is long range. We have non-local self-energy effects. What does it make sense to do this?
I think that the sense that it makes is to see that there are these differences, and that tells you that you indeed will have to take the theory in some new directions.
It's a nice tendency that just to make your standard is, Robert would be interested to make different chromium concentration to see what is the spectral weight changing the chromium. So it's better to look to tendency, not just to numerical stuff, because this is really...
But still, it's an interesting question. Jim, you have a lot of this different energy. Could you say something about K-dependent?
Not yet.
Okay.
I mean, in the data we've taken so far, I think that the surface bulk of changes with photon energy are dominating. Well, I'll show you one figure at the end if we have some time that might...
Do we agree if the weight depend on temperature or not?
I think not much.
The system is disordered. There is chromium around which is not clean. There's disorder around. So the width can be also increased by disorder effects.
That's true. However, if you just increase the width, like adding in some Lorentzian broadening to the theory, it doesn't change the weight. So the weight's problem still. Yeah. No, there's lots of stuff to study now. We actually have some of the beginnings of what you guys are asking for, and I'll show you some bits of that. This just to give you a feeling for why the small spot matters. These are pictures of actual cleaved surfaces of V2O3. We didn't just go out and get some crystals, you know, out of a cave somewhere and measure them. These are made at the group at Purdue that have been generating most of the world's supply of V2O3 now for 20 years. And so these guys are as good as anybody. They know how to anneal the samples, and they do that for us, and so on and so forth. But this is a micrograph with a field of view of, say, 2 by 2 millimeters, 2.6 by 2. And this is now expanded 20 times, so the field of view is the order of of 500 microns by 500 microns. And this is 100 micron spot size. And so you can see now the steps that come on these cleaved surfaces, and you can see that there are little regions where you can get lucky where you don't have a lot of steps. And this, I think, is the kind of thing that's going on when we try to probe this stuff. And I must say, I just hadn't really appreciated this aspect of the situation. Usually we think about small spots, at least I do, for looking at small samples. And I don't think about it as a way to really deal with inhomogeneities and getting rid of steps and things like that. But this is the kind of thing you see. Here are some other ones. These are doped now. It seems as though the chromium doping makes material that's nicer from the point of view of cleaves. This is a 2.8% chromium, and this is a 3% chromium. And here you see 100 micron spot sizes. And you can sort of count the number of step edges now. And here in this one, you could imagine that you might see data that's pretty nice. And so there's a lot to be learned, I think, about the systematics of what happens as you dope the material. It's interesting, the crystal growers tell me that if you dope it with a little bit of chromium, it seems to have the effect of making the oxygen distribution more homogeneous in the material. And it is a fact that, you know, the evidence for that is that if you just have chromium doped material, just a little bit of chromium, the phase transition temperature comes out to be about what it's known to be without a lot of annealing, whereas if you have pure V2O3, it seems to be the case that you really have to anneal it with some careful procedure that they do in order to develop what they think now is the right bulk transport properties. And they don't know why that is. I mean, I say to them, why does putting a little chromium in somehow help? They don't know. And I don't know either. But this, I think, is the kind of thing that's going on. When we tune the spot around, and it's, so it's going to vary from cleave to cleave. It's going to happen that you'll get a cleave where the peak just ain't big. And there will be ones where you hit a lucky place, and like in that really peaky advanced light source spectrum, it is very robust. Doesn't have a sum rule that guarantees its robustness, but, you know, I think it's really there. Well, here's just a little bit of exploration around in the materials to kind of see what the phase transition looked like. This is pure V2O3, just now data taken at 500 EVs rather than 700, but it's high enough to show you peaky things. So this is going across the phase boundary, metal to insulator. This is the titanium doped sample. You may remember titanium is in the direction of squeezing, tends to depress the insulating phase and stabilize the metallic phase. And these all look a lot alike, I would say. And I'll make you a comparison of metal phases in a minute. This is chromium 1.2%. This is a magic chromium concentration, because this is the one where you can access all three phases by varying the temperature. So it's really pretty from an experimental point of view, and maybe it's pretty theoretically as well. And so here you go from AFI as you increase the temperature to the metallic phase and then back to the insulator, and you see all of those changes. So this is the entire spectrum, and we're going from, it's not plotted in order, but this is the AFI phase, and then jumps to a metal, and then jumps back to an insulator. And these are the more detailed spectra showing you how the vanadium part goes. No theory now for the AFI phase, but of course that's the phase we often see. Here's a little comparison of PM phase data. So this is pure V2O3, chromium 1.2. So we're going just a little bit over in the phase diagram in the direction of expanded pressure, and the titanium one. And this is, of course, exactly the kind of system as you'd like to see. But frankly, I'm a little nervous because I'm looking from cleave to cleave to cleave in different materials. And you already know that it matters a lot, the details of where I happen to take the data and what's the quality of the surface. I sort of have the feeling that the decrease from pure V2O3, that's the red one, to the black one, chromium doped, that might be real because I see the quality of the cleaves getting better as I put the chromium in. So I have the feeling that the tendency to decrease there is maybe believable. On the other hand, I don't know, this bothers me a bit. I guess I would have thought that you might see a peakier peak as you as you start to suppress the insulator phase. So I kind of thought that the titanium doped one would be bigger, and I think we just don't have enough data to know yet. This is kind of interesting. This is the AFI phase, and we're not talking how peaky it is, but this the sort of the edge here is moving around, and we don't have a theory for the AFI phase yet, but it's very clear that there seem to be some real differences from in the doping dependence, and I think that probably is a trustworthy effect. Don't know what to think about it yet. Let's see the red and the green, that's the titanium and the pure, so that's here, and then on one side that's going towards higher pressure, that's squeezing, and then these two are both more heavily doped, chromium, so that's moving towards the insulator stable phase. Well, so that brings us then to the PI. You know, what about the insulator phase, the PI phase, which we observe in heavily doped chromium samples? So we're now at a 2.8% sample. The theory that was done by Dieter and his guys, I think, was for 3.8%. They went far out in the phase diagram when they did the calculation, and so we have tried to go as far out as we can, get the samples to try to get there. And so we have some data taken across this phase boundary. There's a PI in the AFI phase. Again, I'm just comparing on resonance and off resonance. This is the Auger stuff. And the reason I'm showing you this is that you'll notice a little bulgy thing here. That little bulgy thing in the highly doped chromium samples, which is also showing here, this is the phase transition now. This is showing you now V2O3 in the PM paramagnetic phase, and then going at a roughly the same temperature out in the phase diagram to the PI phase. And so that's the insulator. And you notice the little bulgy thing here. That's actually chromium 3D emission. There's always something coming up that you might have preferred not to be there. How do I know it's chromium 3D? Well, this is some data taken by my student back in the days of low resolution on a 1.8% sample, looking now at a resonance in the chromium 3D cross-section, which comes at the chromium 2P edge, which is out around 570 eVs. And in fact, this was the enhancement of the chromium 3D part at this special photon energy that enhances chromium 3D. You see it coming up, and then he subtracted the spectrum, and so this is this chromium thing. And then it's compared here to CR203 XPS, and that's the chromium 3D peak coming up. And if your reaction is the same as mine, it's sort of, how can you possibly find it so easy to see 1 or 2% chromium in this sample, you know, showing up on top of 100% vanadium? You know, how could it be? So I talked a little bit about that with George Zabotsky, and the idea that we had comes back to Anderson-Hamiltonian kind of thinking. Maybe you could get at this somehow with the kind of things you were showing yesterday, that different ways of looking at the orbitals emphasize different mappings onto model Hamiltonians. So the notion is that perhaps for CR203, if I step back to a case where the hybridization is zero, that the D3 to D2 peak now really comes below the oxygen band, and you now turn on hybridization, and the hybridization is weak, and you leave most of the real 3D weight out here and put only a little bit in the oxygen 2P band. So that would correspond to this situation. For V2O3, there is some evidence that if you, and George and I think, that if you have no hybridization, that the D2 to D1 transition is actually sitting here near the bottom of the oxygen band. And now the hybridization is pretty strong, and you push stuff out here, make a bound state out there in the impurity model, leave behind quite a lot of weight here, so that relatively it tends to be that perhaps there's more chromium 3D sitting at this general energy than there is vanadium 3D, so that even a little bit of chromium perhaps is seeable. I mean, we're just waving our hands here a bit, but this fits in with some of the ideas that George and I and Jan Zonin had in the early years. Why would the chromium sit down here? Probably the stability of a half-filled T-shell. So probably some stabilization associated with a half-filled shell. And maybe also because chromiums are kind of funny, if you look at the periodic table, you find that it comes out of sequence. That is, the electron occupation of chromium tends to jump as you go from vanadium to chromium, and one more electron wants to be in the D shell. That's one of the little irregularities in the sequence. So as we look at the PM to PI transition, there is this little bit of stuff here, and we've figured out a scheme for trying to take it out. And we're pretty confident this is the right thing to do, because you can see that the on-resonance spectrum, which suppresses the 3D emission because it just enhances vanadium, really shows us what this line shape should look like. And so we have a trick for trying to take this out, and this shows you our trick. So just so you have some feeling for what kind of a correction we're doing, that's the kind of correction we're doing, because we want a spectrum that we can actually compare to the calculation that Dieter and his guys did. So here now is some comparisons for the insulator phase. So this is the PI data at chromium 2.8%. The calculation was done at 3.8%, and this is for 5 EV theory. And so far, the temperatures are 1100K and 700K. Dieter says they've just finished the 300K data, the 300K calculation, and they are discussing it. And so we don't have a copy of that yet. But this is the kind of thing that you see. This was the original one that was published in PRL. You'll notice a lot of weight here near the chemical potential coming up, sort of this gap filling weight that I think is real in the theory. And then that gap filling weight comes down in a much smaller dab at 700 kelvins. And presumably at 300 kelvins, it's going to be even smaller. I don't know. The data shows some kind of a two-featured object here. And that tends not to be there in the theory, except for this gap-filling weight, which isn't really a spectral feature. So there seems to be just something different about the insulator phase that I don't see prospects for that getting fixed. And I think Dieter wouldn't fight with me if he were in the room.
But there is some orbital ordering or something happening in the insulator phase, right?
And the PI phase?
No.
No,
but in the, I see, so it's paramagnetic insulator.
So we're trying, yeah, to not have the magnetism involved. This is a 300 Kelvin calculation done at 4.9 EV. I'm not quite sure why it just happens that we have this one, but the theorists did this one. This is kind of interesting because it gives you a hint that it may well be that this theory is going to get the gap roughly right. I don't know what will happen at 5.0, but low temperature at a U of 5, but it seems as though maybe the gap's gonna come not too bad. We'll see. I mean, this is in progress. This is all three curves, just in case your eye wanted to be able to make a comparison with all the currently available to us theory curves for the PI phase at all temperatures. Well, this is an effort to make apples and apples as much as I can for the comparison for the phase boundary. So this is the 500 EV data and 500 EV. So it's all 500 EV data, 175K, 300K in the theory, 5 EVs. And then you can just run your eye back and forth and see how the spectra change and see how the theory change. 3.8% chromium in the theory, again, T of 300K. So there is some difference in temperature here. I guess if I'd known that these guys were going to generate data at 300, theory at 300K, maybe we would have taken data here. But, our instinct on the beamline is always to get the temperature down as much as you can, because that sharpens up the spectra. And if you're only going to pay one visit there for, one shot in April 02, then you just tend to get the temperature down. And I suppose maybe this will turn out to be significant, another 100.
Well,
another 100, 200 kelvins.
Jim, the small peak in the theory.
I suppose that that's a little dab of the gap-filling weight still present at 300 kelvins for that U value. That's my presumption. This is this gap-filling part, and I want to say a little bit about that in a minute.
If I remember correctly, the optical gap is like 1 eV at least, no?
This little dab here is a few tenths, like 3 or 4 tenths of an eV, so it is less than whatever the optical gap is, so there's stuff on the other side of the chemical potential.
Sure, but what I'm trying to say is that at 300 degrees, I mean, it should be more or less like zero temperature because the temperature is much less than the gap.
Well, these guys have argued to us that the tendency to gap fill is a real part of the theory, and then maybe it becomes a quantitative question.
At least the gap in the same chromium concentration, you think it's over the 1 eV?
If I remember, I mean, we predicted some optical stuff, so I have some recollection that the optical gap in the paramagnetic insulator wasn't very small. I mean, it was certainly larger than 300 degree Kelvin. So you don't expect temperature to be so significant.
I don't know. It depends on what the characteristic energy scale of floating around for the quasiparticle peak is. I would think.
Phase, no?
Yeah, but of course the metal's not far away. That's of course another frustration for me. In the days when I looked at peaks that were linked to Kondo theory, the theorists would tell me that if they had this and such a parameter, then there would be such and such a Kondo temperature. And here now, when I ask Dieter, what's the underlying characteristic temperature? He's not sure, he's going to infer it, I think, from the calculation, but so this is that sense in which it's not really a Kondo peak, even though it's being generated in a kind of Kondo way off of an impurity model, but it seems, I get the feeling anyway, that the underlying emergent energy scale is not so well known, but presumably that underlying energy scale has something to do with the phase transition. That like happens in the cerium problem. It's not U, and it's not the hybridization or epsilon F that controls the phase transition. It's really the Kondo temperature, the emergent energy scale. Similarly here, all the energy scales of the phase transition are a lot less than all of the values of the gap. You know, all the charge fluctuation energies are too big in V2O3 to be controlling the phase transition temperature.
But just to make a comment on that, how these various energy scales behave as we go to the Mach transition has been worked out in quite a degree of detail in the...
I just haven't read the papers carefully enough.
At least in models. So now one can, of course, argue about numbers and quantitative things, and that will depend on how close you are to the transition and is the temperature and how much gap filling spectrum you have. But the basic quantities have been worked out.
Okay. I apologize. That's just my not having gone through the Reviews of Modern Physics article careful enough, and I will do that.
There was a lot more work after that. This is an order.
Okay, so I'll educate myself better about what's known from the calculations that have been done. I mean, there is an aspect that's just not treated so far that I think is important because of what I did with Richard Martin on the cerium phase transition, and that's, of course, there's no entropy in these calculations yet. So presumably the phase transition as a function of temperature happens because you flip from one phase to another and you get the entropy back in the high temperature phase. And there's, there's nothing of that in there. These calculations are in some sense predicting zero temperature phase transitions, and the phase boundaries all involve what's going on with the entropy change. And so that strikes me as being still a quantitative issue that we should remember when we make casually say, do you get the phase boundary or not? Well, here's an effort to try to do temperature dependence. Long time ago when I touted our early work to Gobi, he said, you guys, you never did the temperature dependence. So we tried to do some temperature dependence. And here what I've tried to do, the motivation was really to try to look at the insulator phase, and that's because in the early stages it looked like the metal phase data agreed pretty well with the theory, but the insulator phase was really bad, And one of the ways in which it was bad was that the high temperature theory had the gap filled in a lot. And so the question was, you know, was that for real? And the theorists convinced me that it wasn't just a nuisance, that it was really interesting that this Mott gap would fill in, you know, that a true semiconductor band gap wouldn't do that. You would excite whole particle pairs, but you wouldn't fill the gap in. So we tried to look for that. Suga absolutely refused to let me do this on his end station, to take any temperature up to 750 kelvins in there. So we had to do it in the home lab. So then we're a little bit stuck, you see, because in the home lab, we're going to be working with low photon energies, and I've made a big point to you about how that's very surface sensitive. However, that's why I thought maybe it wasn't so bad to tackle the insulator phase, because the way in which the surface enters is that it's a more correlated phase, which drives you to the insulator. So if anything, the surface is a more strongly correlated insulator, and if we can observe something in the way of gap filling, which I will argue to we have done, then I think it's significant. So, you know, that it's a simple experiment. You put the sample in the spectrometer and you measure the spectrum at 300 kelvins and then you heat it up to 750, which is about as high as we could reasonably do in our system. And then you try to look and see if there's a change. This is measured at 21 EVs. That's the helium lamp 1 line, and this is the helium lamp 2 line, and there is some little change there, which we'll look at more carefully in a minute. And then you cool it back down again and you see if the spectrum comes back. And it does, except that there was a little, a tenth of an EV shift. But apart from a tenth of an EV shift, we reproduce the spectrum at low temperatures. So we've heated it up and cooled it back down, which we think is what we want to do. And the tenth of an EV shift, I guess, has to do with some kind of surface pinning of the Fermi level on an insulator. That would be my understanding. So I believe that this is valid data at this photon energy for heating the stuff up to a pretty good temperature. So this is a blow up then of what we see, and the part that I think might be significant is that there is a change. It's very similar results at 20 and 40 EVs, and there is a change in the shape here. Which goes from concave to convex. Is that the right way to say it? So this is the kind of difference. You see a real change in the shape of the curve. I mean, it's just a qualitative change in the way the curve comes in. And actually, if I would compare that to the theory, it's not so bad. And in fact, if this was the only data I ever took, we'd probably say, wow, we have wonderful agreement between theory and experiment if we only heat up the sample enough. Actually, I think this curvature change is for real. And the other similarities to the theory we would know are misleading and have to do with the low photon energy, because at higher photon energies, we don't just have a single peaked spectrum like we seem to be seeing in the low photon energies. And so here's a little comparison of lots of data to just try to help orient you. So this is all this high energy stuff, which we have measured in the insulator phase, always shows a kind of two-featured, you know, there's a peak here and a peak there. That's the part that the theory never seems to get. If we measure at low photon energies with the helium lamp, this peak comes down. This black one and the red one, so the black one and the red one are a scraped sample and a cleaved sample done in the home lab. This is PI phase and AFI phase. But the cleaved one seems to show the shoulder here a little more sharply, and the scraped one seems not to show it. But the tendency is that this peak comes down and produces something that actually looks quite a lot like the theory. So, I mean, I don't know what that's telling me. You make a more strongly correlated surface, and it somehow produces something that looks more like the theory. I don't know if that's just an accident or what. But I think we actually have seen that this slope, you know, this kind of curvature coming in, as opposed to that kind of curvature coming in, that seems to be really happening. We tried to do this in the metal phase. So we got pure V2O3. We tried to just do exactly the same experiment in the metal phase. Maybe less meaningful there, because that's the one where you don't see much of a peak, but we thought we'd try it anyway. At the point where in the point in the protocol where you heat it up and then you cool it back down, we simply didn't reproduce the low temperature spectrum. So we have never succeeded in heating pure V2O3 up to 750 Kelvin and coming back down again and having the same surface we started out with. So thus far, efforts to do the metal phase version of this simply haven't succeeded. And I don't know if I can do this on a synchrotron beamline, but we'll see. I mean, that's clearly in my mind that I would like to go to some place where you really see the peak and then do the high temperature experiment and watch what happens. Yeah.
So about this temperature dependence in the metal, the data you showed us were in pure V2O3 were taken at 170 or 190, right?
Yeah.
What happens if you heat up a little bit, say up to 300K?
Yeah, I probably should have done it at 300. I just don't have the data to show you at 300. Because and
the critical point is around 400, right? 450.
Yeah, 450.
There should be pretty dramatic effects already as one comes close to that critical point. Probably, you know, heating up to 700 will cause the problems that you explained, but.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I can't tell you what this looks like at 300 Kelvin. That in our minds, it hadn't triggered to me that I really cared about that. So we just cooled the sample. It's a lot easier to cleave them at the low temperatures, too. That's this trick where you go close to the phase transition and you set up a little stress. We actually do set up a little, you have one part of the sample cold and you touch it with something that's a little hot, and then that sets up a little thermal gradient which seems to stress the sample. I wanted to now, if you'll bear with me for maybe 10 more minutes, I wanted to make a little argument to you about optical spectra that might be supportive to people who are interested in pair theories in this stuff. And for that purpose, I want to compare to you some things about CR203 and V203. CR203 is what I would call a real Mott Hubbard insulator in the sense that if you look at the properties of the material, you can well understand them in terms of what you know to be the properties of chromium 3 plus ion dilutely present in Al203. As far as its magnetic moment, the optical spectrum, and so on. And here I'm looking at optical spectra. This is the sort of thing I did my thesis on, actually. This is CR203. Let's first look at the chromium 3 plus ion. So this is the famous Sugano-Tanabe phase diagram for three d electrons in a crystal field, a cubic crystal field. And this is how the ionic levels split out with 10dQ. And this is where ruby is. And the transitions from here to here are quartet to doublet transitions that are the ruby R lines that lays. And so these are against the, these all involve three electrons in the T orbital. And the reason you've gone from quartet to doublet is that you've frustrated the Hund's rule, so you have coupled them up in the internal symmetry. You just coupled up the internal degrees of freedom differently. This is another one where the details of the orbital parts are different. So these sharp transitions, and the reason why they don't vary with 10dQ is that there's almost no charge change in going from the ground state up to these levels. These guys that are changing a lot with 10dQ are all the ones where you take an electron out of a T orbital and stick it into an E. And this is the optical spectrum. And so the little sharp line guys are the R lines. The next broad one is actually lots and lots of, it's very broad because it couples to phonons, and that's because the charge changed in the transition. Then there's little sharp guys again, that's these guys, and then a broad guy again, that's this guy. And so this is really well understood stuff. And if you look at CR203, you see all the same patterns repeated. Here's the sharp stuff, the broad stuff, the sharp stuff, the broad stuff, and then you come to the big charge transfer edge in the system. And the only difference in the spectrum between that and ruby turns out to be little subtle effects that involve Frankel exciton formation that I did my thesis on. But it all is well understandable in terms of chromium 3 plus ionic structure now weakly coupled in the solid. If you do the same thing in V203, of course you can put vanadium dilutely in Al203, and the same thing works out for the dilute system. So this is now the Sugano-Tanabe diagram for 2D electrons in Al203. Again, you have the transitions, which are now triplet to singlet, that give you little sharp line things, and then ones that are broad. And the same pattern happens, sharp, broad, sharp, broad, and this is all really, really well understood from years and years and years ago. These are the analogs of the R lines in Ruby. So these sharp lines are spectroscopic fingerprints for this ionic structure.
So what is the main transition in vanadium?
What do you mean by the main transition?
Well, the lowest one.
The lowest one for vanadium 3 plus ion will be this one against the Hund's rule. So it's triplet to singlet, and that's a measure of the lowest energy Hund's rule energy in the system.
What's the value for that optical node?
Oh, that's probably about 1 volt.
Right.
It's here's an EV scale, so it's about 1 EV. Right. Yeah, measured. Okay, so now, what happens if you look at V2O3 from this chromium oxide point of view? And this bothered me. You know, as a student, I had worked on the optical spectrum of CR203, and just right when I got out of school and I had my first job, that's when the Bell Lab stuff came out on V2O3. And in a short time, all of these optical properties were measured, and they told me that this is a Mott Hubbard insulator, in some sense, just like nickel oxide or just like CR203. But if you look at the optical spectrum that was measured, this is taken from John Fan's thesis, probably not published, done at Harvard, but the data that was taken at Bell Labs is essentially the same. I took this because it's really optical absorption, and I can compare it directly to optical absorption. But here's the antiferromagnetic insulator phase spectrum and the insulator phase spectrum. And this is this V2O3 spectrum. This is vanadium 3 plus and Al2O3. And I mean, there's simply no comparison. You know, the features that are characteristic of vanadium 3 plus are just not in this spectrum. So I believe that you can't understand the insulating phases of this system based on an underlying vanadium 3 plus ion. There's some underlying something else. And I tried to get at that in my early days at Lincoln Lab by getting the crystal growers to make vanadium aluminum oxide and try to just see how does the spectrum evolve. And of course, nature never does what you want. And it turned out that in this system, unlike in the chromium oxide aluminum oxide system, there's a phase gap. So as you put the vanadium in, eventually the system phase separates until you jump all the way up to V2O3. So that's already maybe beginning to tell you that this system doesn't like to just vary smoothly, you know, all the way across, and maybe there's really some difference. So we ended up studying down in this range, less than 8% vanadium in there. And that might not seem like much to you, but the statistics are pretty interesting in this crystal structure. This is a crystal structure with lots of near neighbors, where near means one oxygen that bridges. So first near neighbors are pretty special. There are these C-axis pairs. But second, third, and fourth have 3, 3, and 6 near neighbors. So as soon as you go out to even just the second shell, you're beginning to get lots of near neighbors. And at 8%, it doesn't take very many percent of impurities in there to generate for you lots of probability of near neighbors, and I won't do the little calculation here, but it's easy to work out the statistics. So this is just a little vignette of what happened in that early experiment, which I published in a PRL in the mid-70s. I looked at the 1.21 EV line. So this is the triplet to singlet transition, and these at low percentage are the main lines that you see. And then as you increase the concentration, the spectrum sort of builds up multiple extra lines. The same thing is seen in heavily doped ruby. Art Schallow and his students studied this quite some time ago as they were working on ruby lasers. And it's just exchange coupled pairs. I mean, it's understood that this involves near neighbors that are weakly coupled by antiferromagnetic exchange interactions. But the basic underlying electronic structure is still vanadium 3 plus ions. And so, in fact, over the 0 to 8% range, you still continue to see that spectrum. I made a little plot of the integrated area, how the integrated area changes as a function of concentration, and it's essentially linear. You can say to yourself, let's suppose that near neighbors at first, second, third, fourth have a more molecular character, say, and therefore a different optical spectrum. and therefore drop out of this weakly coupled pair spectrum. And it's easy to do what that calculation is and to plot what the deviations from linearity are. And so for the fourth near neighbors, where there are six of them, it's a pretty big deviation, even at 8%. And for the second and thirds, which involve three, it's a smaller deviation, but still outside the error bars of the measurement. On the other hand, for the first near neighbors, where there's only one, you really don't have very many of those near neighbor pairs by the time you get to 8%. And I couldn't tell the difference. I mean, I just simply couldn't distinguish in this range, although it's sort of about the time you get to the phase boundary is sort of where the numbers are beginning to get a little greater. So I concluded, I mean, that's the thrust of the paper, was to say the spectrum's really different between V2O3 and vanadium 3 plus at Al2O3. So why is that? And it seemed to me that it must be that the near neighbor pairs break down the vanadium 3 plus identity in V2O3. And why the first near neighbor pairs? Well, if it was the second to the fourth, I should have seen it. Even at 8%, I got enough pairs in there to detect a deviation from just seeing as much, you know, just put one more vanadium in, one more vanadium in, see the transition probability, see the transition probability, see the transition probability. So I think that you have to jump to this part of the phase diagram, and then you've got lots of vanadium in there, and now you're into the regime where the insulator phase is built out of some kind of new localized unit, which I think is the C-axis pairs. So the kind of theories that, for example, you have been working on are very attractive to me, of course, because they take up this idea and try to do something with it, which I could never do, that perhaps there's an underlying unit, which are the C-axis pairs, that serve as the localization centers in the system. And of course, that then takes you to the comments that you were making. You should now have a K-dependent self-energy that has something to do with having these local correlations. And the picture, I guess, would be that in the insulator phase, that the charge on a pair would be nominally frozen to be a fixed amount, but that if I would look at the charge on an individual vanadium 3 plus ion, it would be fluctuating still. I think that's kind of the idea, that I would have delocalization within a pair, and so I would see some mixture of valence states referred to the vanadium ion, but that there would be some well-defined number of electrons on a vanadium pair in the insulating phases, and it would have to carry the right spin and all that kind of stuff, and that's the sort of thing that these guys have been trying to calculate in the toy models. I shouldn't say toy models because they don't look very toy-like when I look at a 40-page paper in PhysRev. But and now there are efforts made to try to do this within the density functional and cluster community. I think Sasha is now involved in this work, and so we'll see what happens. And who knows? Maybe that will help the metal spectrum. You know, if you're going to put these kind of correlations in to get the insulator right, they're present in the metal as well, and maybe some of these differences in the metal spectrum will be improved as a result of thinking the K-dependent self-energy. Well, I'm done. I mean, you've been very patient. I apologize.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, I was going to show you one effort to do angle resolve photo emission. So this is done at 585 EVs, which we think is above this resonance region. And it's now in the angle resolve mode. And it's one of these plots that has high intensity and, well, I guess it's high intensity and low intensity. And anyway, there are some angle-dependent effects here. And maybe it'll turn out that, you know, maybe if we keep working and learn enough, we'll discover we can do angle resolve photo emission and stuff. I mean, that, of course, that's the dream. But yeah. So, but it's not been easy, V2O3. Real hard. But at least there's a peak.
Can I ask this question?
Yes.
Why should I even see the single particle or let's say the many body but single particle type of states of vanadium in the optical spectrum, because like you showed, you have excitonic effects there, so there are strong Coulomb correlations there. So any optical excitation, if I look at the induced field, which you induced by applying your external perturbation, is due to many interacting electron hole pairs, which are Coulomb correlated. So I would expect that not only you get shifts of the underlying single particle peaks, but you get also shifts or changes in the actual spectra because of these many-body Coulomb interactions between different electron hole pairs.
You could.
Do you look for something like a single particle type of feature in an optical spectrum? This looks to me.
Well, it's actually a single ion. It's actually a single ion kind of feature that I'm looking for, not single electron.
Yeah, but they are also strongly changed and modified by Coulomb.
Well, that's why I showed you as a calibration in a sort of a large scale of things, CR203. And if I would show you manganese oxide or nickel oxide or any of your favorite Mott Hubbard insulators, it would be so that you could understand the optical spectrum as weakly coupled X3 plus, X2 plus, whatever it is. So those are the systems Mott talked about in the early days that really do come back to weakly interacting ions. And V203 is just different from that. That's what I'm trying to tell you. It's just farther out. And I frankly think that's why you can see this phase diagram in V203. It's because you aren't really going back and forth between weakly interacting vanadium pairs and a metal. I don't know how hard you'd have to squeeze nickel oxide to make it be a metal, but you'd pretty hard. And CR203, you know, it's going to squeeze those things to be. So I think these materials that show you these pretty metal insulator phase diagrams are actually, in some sense, far from Mott Hubbard insulators, that something has happened in the electronic structure that's broken them down already and taken them away from the ionic state. Maybe I'm...
No, listen to you, it seems like if you are thinking that when there is the insulator, you are breaking some kind of covalence in the system. This is not true. That is essentially, if you look to the covalency, the mixing between copper and oxygen, this is just untouched by the transition. This is just a constant.
Yes.
So when you think of insulator, it's not that we are talking about saying the charge is not localized on vanadium, but essentially the localization of charge is a very little different. It's almost nothing, I would say. The localization of charge between vanadium and oxygen around would be just a constant around the transition. You don't have to think like if really the charges are on vanadium.
But still in all, I think as you go through the phase transition, the change has to be pretty subtle, because otherwise you wouldn't see it at such low temperatures and such low pressures. But in a real Mott Hubbard insulator, the charge is rather well localized, I would say. Of course they're covalent, or you wouldn't have super exchange interactions. But the optical properties and the magnetic properties are simply dominated by the local quantum structure of the ion. I think that's just experimentally clear. And they never are metals. Can't make them be metals. So somehow V203 is already far over towards the metal side of things. And maybe it's a combination of the sorts of things I was mentioning in this little sort of Anderson model picture, that the vanadium, perhaps the bare vanadium transition in the Anderson language, sits in the oxygen band, and then the hybridization is pretty big. And so you have a lot of mixing between the vanadiums and the oxygens, more than happens in chromium. And maybe it's not just the hybridization, but it's where the original, where the atomic orbitals before hybridization are sitting in the transitions, and that matters a lot to what kind of coupling you get to the oxygens. I mean, maybe these are kind of things that could come out of the calculations that Ole described. Well, anyway, so I thank you again. It's appreciate it.